Hello and welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 75 of the Uncovered podcast. I'm Behram Kazi, you can find at Def Mango on Twitter. And with me, as always, is Jared Kimber, who you can find absolutely everywhere. We've got lots of topics, Jared, off the field. There have been a bunch of things that have happened. Some of them are direct, kind of linked to on-field stuff, but we'll start off with Jimmy reaching the 700 mark in Test cricket. Of course, he becomes the third bowler ever to, you know, accomplish that feat of getting 700 cricketers out in Test cricket. And also, he's the first fast bowler. He's probably going to overtake Warney because Warney's at 708, so he's 8 wickets away. And he's gotten to this landmark in 187 Test matches at an average of 26.52. Now, that average was never that good in, let's say, his first 87 Test matches. After that, Jimmy Anderson really started peaking. And sure, he has regressed in the last year or two. But, you know, before that, that was the best that we've seen of Jimmy Anderson ever. And there's this phrase that gets overused with him that, oh, Jimmy has aged like fine wine. Well, at this point, I would like to probably flip that. Like, this fine wine has aged like Jimmy Anderson. That's where we're at.
Did you see his parents in the ground for the Test match?
Yeah.
To go back to the question we were asked on the previous podcast about what makes someone able to bowl fast, genetics plays a big part. And it's just like, you're looking at his parents going, wait a minute, if he's 41, how old are his parents? Because they don't look particularly that old either, you know. And so, genetics plays a very, very big part in where we are. But look, I think the big question for me is, you know, we've talked about Jimmy so many times of, is that it? Is this going to be the highest amount of wickets we ever see from a seam bowler in Test cricket? And I think that if we had seen, if Courtney Walsh had played in a similar era, I think he would have taken even more wickets. I think he was a slightly better bowler than Jimmy Anderson as well. They're both great. So we're both talking about the top level. But we know that he played so much more in first-class cricket and had to absolutely dominate people in first-class cricket rather than in Test cricket. But the point being is that does mean that in the space of, 40 years, we've had two guys who potentially could have done that. So I wonder if there were more guys before that, especially looking at some of the old county bowlers who ended up with thousands and thousands of wickets, right? Whether we will see someone else able to do that. But then you've got the argument of, will there be enough tests played? Will the best bowlers actually play enough tests, even if there are enough tests played? And will they have to come from India, England, or Australia to even be within a shout to be able to do something like this again? It's remarkable. I put a tweet up about how Jimmy Anderson's Test career started just before MySpace, right? You know, really, both of social media as we know it.
Yeah.
There was one guy who's really angry. He's like, dumb. Social media started 6 years before. And I was like, mate, no one knew what social media was until MySpace got big. Right, like, but MySpace is the thing that made social media into social media, but that just shows, like, there are whole people listening to this podcast who have never lived in a year of their life without Jimmy Anderson being alive. Right? Without Jimmy Anderson being a Test bowler, yeah. It's a remarkable record to be able to do that. The only other seam bowler I think who has played as many years is Imran Khan, and he doesn't really bowl by the end of his career. And was an all-rounder, so it is slightly different. But it's just ridiculous that what he has done so far. And, you know, I think we can all nitpick at his record of, you know, of, oh, this, he didn't take as many wickets when he played away. And, he wasn't as useful in certain situations and everything else. But it's like, he took 700 test wickets. Like, do you know how hard it is to take a test wicket, to take 50 test wickets, to take 100 test wickets? And he's got 700 of them. It is absolutely ridiculous that a seam bowler could take that many wickets.
Yeah, and I mean, even if we look at his away record, you know, if you look at it in recent years, sure, he might not be as incisive as he is in England, but he doesn't go for runs. He holds up one end. He's, you know, very, very hard to get away. I think that if you look at the 2000s, you know, because in the 90s and 80s, that's like the era of fast bowlers. I feel like Dale Steyn and Jimmy Anderson are two names that come up. Of course, I rate Steyn higher and the numbers suggest that as well. And he was a different beast altogether. But I feel like Jimmy's constant will to upskill and learn and keep his body fit. I mean, longevity is also a big factor in this. You know, not everyone can pull that off. And sure, him giving up limited overs cricket helps, and England playing like 10,000 test matches a year also helps. But what he's achieved over here is actually a record that I feel might never be bested. It can't be broken, just because to get 700 wickets, as is, you'd have to play, you know, 20 years, even if you're playing for England, right? And now even England isn't playing as many test matches as they used to in this last cycle, right? It's reduced for them as well. And the other nations don't play nearly as much. And then you'd need to have a bowler who's ready for test match cricket at 19, 20. So all of those things, if you look at them combined or factor them in, I don't think that cricket will see another bowler who will play test cricket for that long and will, you know, take more than 700 wickets, because it's just, Jimmy himself is like a freak of nature. He's a marvel. And I mean, Courtney Walsh, like you mentioned, was the guy, McGrath was there who came close to 600 or crossed 500, let's put it that way. But 700 is a different number altogether. And you would have to be either the most prolific bowler in history and get there in 15 years, or you need to go as long as Jimmy Anderson did and just make sure your body holds up, which is pretty impossible.
Yeah, so you need to be a freak physical specimen.
Yeah.
Right? So let's put that to a side, because Courtney Walsh and Jimmy Anderson, certainly freak physical specimens, in a way that even McGrath wasn't, if we're being honest, although he was more on that sort of verge. So you need that. The one advantage the next generation player will have will be sports science. So, you know, Tom Brady and these tennis players who are, you know, playing later and later. And we know that we're going to see the best players kept on the field or on the court longer because of that. The problem with cricket is that you would also, for this really to be broken, what has to happen is that probably the three formats need to separate. And test cricket needs to be run as test cricket. And then you need someone who is really, really a good test bowler, but doesn't actually have that much value in what might be the higher paying leagues of T20 cricket by that stage. If that's the case, and we had like test cricket played on its own with very little overlap, except when players occasionally swap sports, you know, like rugby league and rugby union, or NFL and rugby league and rugby union, those sorts of things. There is an opportunity then that teams might play more consistently test cricket because they have to make money and it's sold as a league and all those sorts of things. But you still need to be the freak physical athlete in the first place. And then, you know, a lot of things have to go your way. You know, if you look back with Jimmy Anderson, like it's remarkable that he's even in the position that he's in. You know, his action didn't make as much sense when he was younger. They tried to fix it in England. They almost broke him in half by trying to do that. He's at the cutting edge of sports science when it comes to cricket, because England have really invested in that. But let me tell you, Jimmy Anderson is not exactly the most progressive thinker when it comes to that sort of stuff. And, you know, he's not always happy with all that sort of sports science stuff. So it really is remarkable that, you know, it's gone on to the position it has. But yeah, he physically, it's that ability to, you know, be able to run in and bowl as consistently as those guys do without it taking the sort of wear and tear on your body that it should take.
Yeah. And I think to a certain point, you'd also have to credit his hunger. I think that really counts over here, because a lot of people, they play international cricket for a long time and then they lose that hunger. And that's what a lot of retiring players say, that, oh, we just lost the love of the game. We didn't really feel like competing at that level anymore. Jimmy Anderson does want to compete at that level till he's around. I feel like this guy never wants to retire. And England kind of backs him with that as well. They're like, okay, yeah, if Jimmy wants to stay on, that we're going to keep trusting him. And I feel like even though he might have reached the twilight of his career, Jimmy Anderson is the sort of guy I feel who'd be like, oh, Sachin has played the most number of tests, 200. I'll pick up a fast bowler and beat that, right? I'll play 201. And he may as well do that, right? Because 14 test matches for England is not a long period of time. He'd probably get there in a year and a half. And if he has a good English summer, we very well might see that happening, because, you know, he's still good. It's not like he's garbage, right? Even on this India tour, it's not like he was absolutely decimated. Sure, Jaiswal took him on and whatnot. But still, I feel like, you know, this is a guy who is one good series away from, you know, wanting to stick around for a bit more longer.
Well, it's ridiculous. He's a 41-year-old seamer. He was still England's best seamer in India, wasn't he? Yeah. So, where he's not particularly well-suited as well. So, he's a son of a bitch type of performer. And I think you are right. I do think he's looked at that Sachin record. And I don't know, that doesn't mean he'll make it, because there's a lot of things that need to go right in order for him to do it. I did this. I can't remember which video it was, but we did this thing years ago where I looked at the age of 30, his record was very similar to Matthew Hoggard's, right? And England just moved on from Matthew Hoggard the minute it looked like he'd lost half a yard of pace. And around that same period, I want to say, is when George Bailey smashed Anderson everywhere. And so at that stage, I thought, they're going to do the same with Anderson. They're just going to try and find someone faster and younger to come in. Not long after that, really masters the wobble ball.
Yeah.
And it is the thing, it is the reason we are talking about him today. Mm. It's all well and good to say that Muhammad Asif was the genius behind the wobble ball and Stuart Clark played a big role in it. And some of the, you know, we know that, funnily enough, the guy I was talking about before, Courtney Walsh, also bowled one accidentally, right? So we know that other people have had it. No one has mastered it like Jimmy, not even Muhammad Asif would have if he stuck around. But something else happened to him, I can't remember. But, you know, Jimmy is now bowling balls in that last series where the ball was swinging and with a wobble seam. That's how much he has upskilled that particular delivery. Yeah. We are seeing absolute mastery, right? And outside of Philander and Asif, I don't think, and maybe Stuart Clarke, I don't think I've ever seen a bowler as skillful with the ball in the hand that Jimmy Anderson is. And that's why he's still around at the age of 41. But as I said before, he's also a son of a bitch. Look at him fighting with Shubman Gill. He's still an incredible, you know, competitor, fiercely, you know, he feels it more than other players do. And that is generally what brings you on and what keeps you around is that he wants to keep going.
Yeah.
Look, he's already set up the next part of his career. You know, the tail end of this podcast is fine. I don't know whether he'll go to Sky or if he'll go to BBC or TalkSport or whoever needs him at that stage. But media-wise, it's Jimmy Anderson. He isn't going to have any problems there. Mm. But, you know, he dyed his hair in this series. And I don't know this for sure, but I can tell you I'm pretty positive of this. He dyed his hair because he was sick and tired of everyone talking about his age because he thinks he could still bowl. And that's why he did it. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. And he can come and correct me, but I don't believe I am. That's not the sign of a man who's about to leave the game, right? Like I could have seen him take the 700th wicket and be like, no one's ever done this. No one will ever do this again. If you need me, I'll be on my podcast. And that's not what happened, right? He fought through that and, you know, and continued. And I think it really does tell you a lot about, you know, who Jimmy Anderson is. He just is an incredibly fierce competitor who wants that next wicket. And that is the difference between other athletes who love playing the game and, you know, leave earlier because sometimes the passion goes. His passion has been there from ball one to ball 38,000, whatever he's up to.
Yeah, something like that. And I mean, who's to say in his head he probably wants to beat Murali's record. But, you know, you spoke about the wobble seam and how he's mastered it. Recently with the pro sports people, I was doing these short segments of build your perfect batter, build your perfect bowler. And when wobble seam came up, you know, my co-host picked Muhammad Asif because, you know, he was a pioneer of sorts and it makes sense. But I picked Jimmy because I was like, sure, I get the Asif conversation, but no one has mastered it quite like Jimmy. So he would be my wobble seam bowler in that perfect, you know, assembly of a fast bowler. But anyway, let's move on. Of course, we've mentioned how Jimmy has now played 187 test matches. Well, there were four new entrants to the 100 test match club. Johnny Bairstow, who has 6,000 runs after 100 test matches. Ravi Ashwin, who has over 500 wickets after 100 test matches now. Kane Williamson, who has, 8,500 runs in 100 test matches. And Tim Southee, who has 380 wickets in 100 test matches. So, four very experienced senior pros. They've gotten to that mark. And first, I'll have you rate them in terms of who you think is
sexiness.
The best.
Sexiness.
Yes. And then I want to ask you, how many more of these entrants are we going to see in the future? Because it doesn't seem like that's going to happen too frequently.
Sometimes you just need to take the slips out and bowl defensively. And you also need to be careful with your computer's defense as well. If you need a VPN, go Nord. NordVPN.com/Kimber to get a 2-year contract with a discount, plus 4 extra months and gifts in some markets. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. So put in some dot balls and turn them into maidens via NordVPN.com/Kimber. I think what's remarkable is we saw four in the space of 48 hours. And how many more will we see a year from here on in, based on how cricket's currently being played and the direction it's going? I think Ashwin's probably the best cricketer. Oh, yeah. I mean, I have a bias towards bowlers, so I'd probably pick Ashwin over Williamson just because I think that's more important. But yeah, probably be Ashwin, Williamson, Southie, Bairstow, off the top of my head, if you want me to rate those. I mean, that's almost with no thought at all, but just, you know, you've asked for the hot take. You've got a hot take. But yeah, I do wonder. I think Usman wrote a really interesting piece about how, you know, there was a period where it felt like everyone was playing 100 tests, even, you know, and then we got to a period where it's like, it's really rare to see all format players playing 100 tests again, which is very, very interesting. You know, we had podcasts where people have asked, like, who the worst player to play 100 tests is. And, you know, caveat on that, of course, no one is a bad cricketer if you get to 100 test matches. But yeah, you could argue that certainly Bairstow is probably towards the lower end of that. I don't think he's the worst, by the way.
I mean, when he was a keeper, his average of 37 looked really good. And he actually averaged more with the bat when he kept wicket. Ever since he's given that up, and after those early Bazball successful test matches in which Bairstow kind of single-handedly almost won them those games, it's been downhill for him. And now his numbers, when he's not keeping, look worse with the bat. So you'd have to think to yourself that out of all of the, you know, what do you say, specialist batters who've played 100 test matches, how many of them have averaged less than 40? And I think that's where people kind of have that issue with Bairstow. But you've got to remember, he wasn't always a specialist batter. Cheaper.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Atherton is certainly one that played 100 tests who averaged less than 40, didn't he? I think he might have been another one. Ian Bell averaged over 40. And I'm not sure I think of best, you know, if you, and I really like Belly as a person, and I loved him as a batter as well, but I'm not sure that Bairstow isn't a better all-round cricketer and isn't of more use to you. It just happened to be that Belly played in an incredibly flat batting era. So there was certainly, that was a part of it. But overall, I think all four of them are, you know, really incredible cricketers. And you look at Ashwin, incredibly skillful cricketer, but not a modern athlete. Williamson thrown in, well, you know, probably 2 or 3 years before he was ready to be playing international cricket, had to work it out on the fly, had to overcome the elbow injury. We were talking about Southie before on the previous podcast about how there was a period in his career I thought he might have been finished just because he looked too slow, and he worked out a way to put on that extra half a yard. And then he struggled with his in-swinger and he developed this three-quarter wobble seam ball and, you know, becomes a big player again. And Bairstow, I mean, how many times have we all thought, oh, Bairstow's done. Bairstow's done. And then for about a year, you know, it's like, oh my God, he might be the best. He might be the most impactful batter in the world at the moment, right? And, then you think he's done again.
Impact is the word that's synonymous with Bairstow. He is a match winner across formats. And I think England have valued that aspect of his game a lot. And they won a World Cup. Remember, they were almost down and out in the group stages in 2019. Bairstow scored those tons, right? That got them back on track. And even in test matches, right? You look at that India test match that happened after the IPL and all of that stuff. The first Bazball test between India and England, which, you know, Kohli was kind of having a go at Bairstow. He got charged up. He scored like, what, 170-odd? And they chased 370-odd, if I'm not wrong. That's how it went. So he's had his moments. And I really like Johnny overall as a utility cricketer. And up until the point where he kept wicket, I thought that he was really a cheat code for England, because you get the impact, you get, you know, decent wicket keeping, and
you get wicket keeping.
You get wicket keeping, yeah, sure. But then again, you know, I always looked at him as a plus player. Very recently, I've started thinking of him as, oh, maybe the time is near, but maybe he'll prove us wrong again. That's Johnny Bairstow for you.
Look, I think he's an incredibly driven person. I don't think I'm, you know, breaking any ground here to say that he is a volatile personal, you know, a person. I mean, do you know what I mean? Like, we just saw him sledge as he'd gone out in a losing series. But, you know, I do think he's a person who does crank himself up, and occasionally he gets himself into like almost a Zen state of genius. But there are flaws within his game. And look, all those cricketers, Ashwin can't always play away from home because he's got Jadeja in. So you could, you know, Kane Williamson, essentially against the three best bowling attacks he's gone up against, has only made runs against South Africa, and almost all of those are at home, right? Like, you know, all these players have small issues within their game. And, you know, Tim Southee isn't particularly quick, but they're all fantastic cricketers, right? And, you know, I think, you know, for me, I remember when Southee came on the scene and I was writing my blog and no one knew who I was. And I said that Southee and Ishant Sharma were 10-year bowlers. Mm-hmm. And the amount of abuse I got, and, you know, and sometimes you could see it in those players a long way out. And I don't think I ever saw that with Bairstow. I think I did with Ashwin. I certainly did with Williamson. And so in some ways, you have to respect the fact that Bairstow has forced his way into a conversation with these three other guys when they, from a very, you know, from a skill and a talent level, are just above him. Like, you know, and that doesn't mean that Bairstow won't be dropped soon and, we maybe goes off to be a white ball player as well. But I think he's done incredibly well to get the most out of his career. And maybe not a great player, but certainly a player of great moments.
Yeah, I think that actually sums it up quite nicely. And of course, the other three, I always expected them to play 100 test matches. In fact, I really want Tim Southee to get to 400 wickets as well, because, you know, he's done the hard yards. He's even captained them at this point. And sure, he's not the bowler that he once was. But, you know, him and Bolt, and we were talking about this in the previous podcast as well, him, Bolt, Wagner and Jameson, that four-pronged pace attack is one of the best things we've seen in Test cricket for a while, right? And it got them a World Test Championship as well. So yeah, good job to all of those guys for reaching 100 Test matches, and I'm happy for them. Let's take a short break. We'll be back on Uncovered to talk about the latest from Pakistan. I've got some fun news for you guys. So stay tuned. You're with Bairam and Jared on Uncovered. We'll be back after this short ad. Welcome back to Uncovered, episode 75. You guys are with Bairam and Jared. And I'm not sure if you caught up with this news, Jared, but I'm here going to the stadiums and all of that stuff. And I'm up to date with everything that's happening in the PCB. Much to your surprise, there is a new PCB chairman, right? And the PCB have changed chairmans at a faster rate than Alistair Cook used to have his opening, you know, partners changed.
Partners.
That's where we're at right now. So the new guy, Mohsin Naqvi, was acting as the chief minister of the Punjab province as well. So a conflict of interest went out the window once again. And he was doing both jobs at the same time. And he might even hold another ministry in this new government. So it's all over the park over there. I'm not sure what their plan is. But this guy has come and met Pakistan's key players, like centrally contracted players and other ones as well. Got them in the same room and said a few things where he said that, oh, if I hear of any politics, I'll get rid of all of you guys. And he also said that, look, when I took up the CM job for Punjab, I went through incurred financial loss, and I made that sacrifice to serve my nation. So I expect you guys to make that sacrifice as well. And that's basically where we're at. He's also said that you guys will be sent to train with the army, because when I look at sixes, and if I see one go into the stands, I assume that it's a foreign batter, because Pakistan batters cannot hit sixes which are big enough. So he wants AB9s and KP12s, and for that he's sending them to an army camp. And I really don't know what else to make of this, because just
why doesn't he? If that's the case, why not just pick the soldiers? Why aren't they hitting nines and twelves then?
Absolutely. Good luck sending Azam Khan to an army camp. But you know, it's so ridiculous that just saying this stuff out loud makes me look like a fool. It's just totally bizarre. I can't.
Yeah, anyone who comes in on the nationalistic thing of like, you guys have to make sacrifices, fuck off. This is their job. This is their livelihood. This is their chance of changing their family's immediate future, but also generational future in some cases, right? Also, didn't you use Asif Ali could hit some pretty big sixes, but that's a different conversation. Iftikhar can hit some pretty big sixes too. Anyway, did Afridi go to army? Anyway, sorry.
No, I mean, have you watched Sime Ayoub bat? He's like this big and he hits massive sixes.
Yeah, it's just nonsense. So yeah, all that worries me. A politician coming in saying that there shouldn't be any politics is obviously ridiculous. And like, did you see the Republican response to Joe Biden's State of the Union?
No, I did not.
Address? It's worth, if anyone hasn't seen it, it's worth it for just like, who wrote this? Why did you make her say it this way? Why is she in a kitchen? This is like the cricket version of that. We just like, no, everything you've said here is wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't make any sense. So here's my first question. Does an does a soldier have to have the same version of athleticism in the field that a cricketer does, right?
No.
So how is that? So if he doesn't know that, who's the grown up in the room to say to him, that's a terrible idea? You want them to get fit, that's fine. Let's get the best fitness consultants from around the professional sport. You know, let's get, I don't know, baseball consultants or, you know, surfing consultants or whoever works on core, because cricket is a core sport, right? Let's get that in and make that work and have a go at that. The politics stuff of like, of a person who works in politics coming in and saying there shouldn't be so any politics at cricket is like, okay. The whole idea of sacrificing for your nation. These guys, any professional athlete, male, female, is sacrificing their body every time for whatever the badge is. Now, a lot of them get paid really good money. Some of them don't, but a lot of them get paid really, really good money. But they are sacrificing their ability to walk upstairs when they're older, right? They're sacrificing perhaps in their brain usage if they've been hit in the head too often, right? All those sorts of things.
I mean, ask Will Pukowski.
Phil Hughes, but he's like literally lost his life playing this sport, right? Don't give me shit about this whole thing. I hate people who say all that sort of stuff. Also if you know professional athletes, you know that when they're playing, it doesn't matter who, if they're playing for some shitty team in the middle of nowhere, quite often they just try really hard anyway, because then that's why they're really good, because they're always trying really hard.
Yeah. Also, what he doesn't understand, this new PCB chairman, is that, look, this isn't the army. They're not serving the nation. It's not a do or die, life and death sort of situation at all. This is their profession. They have limited shelf lives. If you're
also
asking,
it's the same for a lot of soldiers. This is where it really annoys me, because I know, I don't know about you, but I come from an era where a lot of people were poor and they went into the army to make money.
Yeah.
Right?
Because that's, they knew the same case over here.
Yeah, like 18 and at 18 to 19, they're like, okay, if I'm going to make money in the next couple of years, it's going to be really hard for me to do that without going to university and getting you this. And I didn't do very well in high school. But if I go to the army, I might be able to get other training within the army. I might even be able to get university education sometimes within the army and to be able to do that. This whole idea that every soldier just does that. I knew guys that went into the army because they always wanted to play with guns. It was really hard to get guns in Australia. Right, there are many different reasons people go into the army. I'm sorry, it's a stupid point, but that's because we've got a politician coming in saying stupid points.
Yeah, I mean the whole sacrifice thing, right? It's so dumbfounded because this is a guy who is obviously, you know, if he was the chief minister of the Punjab, it's not his only job, right? He also has some news channels and whatever. So you are not suffering any financial or incurring any financial losses. Why are you expecting this from the players and strong arming them into making this into a whole nationalistic, patriotic sort of situation? And you are not, you know, helping bridge that gap that has been created between the players and the administration. Like, I am not obviously going to name the player, but I was having a conversation with one of, you know, Pakistan's players, recently. And this came up, the army camp came up, and he was like, ever since the Asia Cup, we've been playing non-stop cricket. Is the army camp the solution here? Like, that is definitely...
Also, someone tweeted this week saying, I hope we talk about it on this episode. And at that stage, I didn't know the full comments. But they were just asking about the army. This happens quite a lot, especially in Asian cricket, but we've seen it Australia and England as well, getting army consultants in and everything else. So I think Brad Haddon's podcast, I saw a clip on TikTok this week of Matt Hayden when they went, they did like an army training session. And Shane Warne was there, and the guy said, you can only take the most important things. And so Shane Warne had his cigarettes there, and the army goes, well, you can't take those. And Shane Warne's like, the king doesn't get on this bus without his cigarettes, right? You tell me if Babar Azam can't do, I don't know, 20 chin-ups or something, right? And he's getting yelled at by some army person. He just doesn't get down and go, okay, find another Babar Azam. Good luck.
Imagine a player is recovering from his injury, like Nasim Shah is going through rehab, right? And you make him do some sort of army exercise that completely fucks him up. Like there's that aspect of this as well.
We've seen that before. We've seen players do those sorts of things and get injuries on these sorts of camps. And I'm not saying these fit. I think these sorts of camps are really important because they do bring the team together. Sometimes they bring them together against the coach, but they do bring the team together and bonding and physical and getting teams fit. Look at Misbah getting the team fit before that England series. I'm not against all that sort of stuff. I am against the idea that the army will fix this problem. And that is specifically what I've seen in a few Western teams and a few Asian teams before. It's just like, that's not what this is. You are not dealing. The army isn't recruiting a millionaire to come in and do something for them, right? Yeah. The army is recruiting a bunch of kids who don't know better, or maybe the sorts of people like your, well, not your chairman, but the PCB chairman, you know, who believe in the cause. That's not the same as Shane Warne and Babar Azam and these other people. And it's ridiculous to think that in that kind of situation, there are ways of doing this sort of stuff. And as I said, I really think bringing a team together, making it so that everyone signs a condition of fitness, and you go to I've forgotten his name, Azam Khan, isn't it? The the wicketkeeper. Uh-huh. You go to him and you go, "We're not trying to get you to be Shadab Khan, right? But we want you to be the best athlete you can be." I think that's a great way of doing it. If it's just a drill sergeant yelling at him, I think that's a stupid way of doing it. You need, I think in these sorts of situations, and this is someone who's worked with teams, and I've worked with multiple teams, right? Everyone needs to buy in. You are with my podcast for your own personal reasons as much as you are here to work for me, right? You know, Muku on the production, and, you know, Ari and Cheyenne and CS and Estelle, all these, you know, Junaid, all these different people who work for us, right? They're here partly because they believe in what we are doing and we're building towards something, right? But they're also here for their own personal reasons. So I know that Cheyenne needs to develop, and that you need to be able to do different things. And Estelle will eventually need a podcast that is all about her and all these sorts of things, because that is part of the reason we're here.
Yeah.
Everyone is the star of their own story, right? And if you're talking about professional athletes, they've been told they are the star from almost the time they come out of the womb. And if you throw them in a situation like this, just thinking it will work, that's not what you need to do. You need to be smart with these things. Yeah. And this sort of stuff, it just sounds, well, I mean, everything he said does not sound smart. Now, he could be a genius. We could be wrong. He's got a career in media or something. He worked for CNN for years. He's a producer. I trust producers because generally they're the smartest people in the media, right? But I also know that what he's said there sounds like a fantasy and like he does not understand modern professional sport. And that is a huge red flag.
I mean, go for specialized coaches with core building and, you know, no-look hits and all of that stuff. There are people who do this for a living. There are specialized jobs, you know, that are held by people who excel at this sort of stuff, who are not the army. There is one guy in Pakistan, Hanif Malik, and every player who's doing, you know, well with respect to power hitting is coming in and crediting him.
Yeah, there's heaps of those people coming through. Yeah, exactly.
Hire that guy. And I recently I asked...
Bring over Trent Woodhill again.
Yeah, I asked Mohammed Wasim of how... what, you know, makes Iftikhar special. And I noticed a tilt in his front foot when he sets himself up to hit sixes. And I was like, is that it? Is that the secret sauce? And he said that his base, the way he sets himself up, allows him to go for those shots. So there are technical things that you could work on, which could improve their power hitting. I agree that big boy power is something that lacks in Pakistan cricket. But sending them to the army when they have no buy-in, if this cricketer is coming and telling me that, oh, we haven't had rest for so long and now we're going to the army, that means that the team is not particularly bought into your philosophy. And if you don't have buy-in, it's not going to work in the first place. So Misbah's team, when they went to train with the army, they had that buy-in. They wanted to get fitter. They knew how important that England series was. But this guy is just coming and strong-arming these players like the last few chairmen have. And he's just basically saying the same thing that, hey, I think this is a solution. You will do it my way or the highway. Otherwise, you're all out.
Here's my other issue. It sounds to me that he doesn't really understand modern professional sport, right? Now, I could be wrong, but it sounds just based on what we've heard so far.
Yeah.
When people come in and they take over a position and straight away they say a bunch of things instantly, I think they are not open to actually seeing what the key issues are and how to fix them.
And remember, the first thing that this guy did was end Harris Rauf's central contract, terminated.
Yeah, I mean,
so it's getting from bad to worse. And who knows, he might not even be the chairman of the PCB next time Jared and I speak.
Anyway, I was going to say, he might not be around next week.
Because Pakistan will still be, but the chairman...
cat might go longer than his job.
Absolutely. Anyway, I was in a PSL presser and I've got something really fun for you. Azhar Mahmood had a very, very hot take. He said that the coach and the fielding captain in a T20 game should be mic'd up and that the PSL should be innovative and we should start this in the PSL. So that instantly made my mind go towards Cronje and Woolmer because they were doing this prior to the 99 World Cup. And then during the World Cup, in the first game, I believe it was against India, Saurav, you know, kind of called them out. And mid-game, they did not know what to do with it because they weren't breaching any laws. But then they did say that, hey, the World Cup is not the time to innovate, so take it off. And mid-game, they took it off. And Woolmer stuck by it, right? Cronje even said that they don't think they were doing anything wrong, but they didn't do it there on. Now, the interesting bit over here is that those guys later, or well, at least Cronje, got caught for fixing. And my head instantly goes there because, of course, Pakistan has had a bad rep when it comes to fixing. Even the PSL has had instances of fixing in the past, in the earlier seasons. And what, if, like, I'm not saying the teams will use this for that purpose. Maybe Azhar Mahmood is being innovative and he's took some inspiration from US sports, particularly the NFL. But, you know, your mind instantly goes to the possibility of, hey, what if there's like a jammer or something that kind of intervenes that call and something else happens? Is that the biggest threat to this sort of innovation, or do you have something else in mind?
I mean, that's probably the worst case scenario, isn't it? I suppose, though, if it's happening in other sports, like most sports have more conversations from off court to on court or off field to off on field than we do, right? They seem to handle it fine. But it's a big difference. The one thing that cricket has is that we have an on-field coach, right? So I love the quarterback position, but I love the Manning brothers probably the most as quarterbacks because they were actually calling the shots, right? They were so brilliant at what they did that they could make the decisions live on the field. And that reminded me of cricket, right? I love the idea of that rather than a quarterback who's just listening to someone in a headset and then going, okay, we'll go with this. And you see it with basketball as well. Like, you know, coaches calling out plays all the time.
Yeah,
that's fine. I don't have an issue with it. But actually,
football, the coach is always on the touchline and he's yelling.
Exactly.
And basketball, that's easier. We've seen Darren Sammy do that during the PSL right now. He's going proper touchline coach right now for
exactly.
Peshawar. So,
So I think it's already happening anyway to a certain extent. I think if we had coaches and other people involved, you would have. I think you'd see more dramatic tactical swings, which would be really, really interesting. But you would be changing the fabric of cricket. I'm not against it. I actually think in some ways that T20 cricket is still too similar to Test cricket and ODI cricket. And I would love to see for some more innovation. Do you know me? I want 15 players playing in every single game. And I think there's heaps of cool innovations that we could be doing. But we have to be aware that we are changing the fabric of the game. And look, as an analyst, would I like to be able to pass messages to a captain? I mean, fuck yeah. I don't think anyone would ever let me have the mic. The player would take the earpiece out and throw it on the ground. I would annoy them too much. But it's really hard to get messages from off-field to on-field, even in the, what Darren Sammy's doing and all these different ways. And I think a lot of coaches feel useless during a game. And that's a weird place to be because it's your future that's on the line, right? But that's also the skill of being a cricket coach, of getting players into the right, you know, mindset that you need them to be in and making the right decisions. So, yeah, look, I can see both sides of it. I'm not massively anti it or massively for it. I could see certain captains wouldn't, cricket currently goes, I think certain captains wouldn't be involved in it and other captains would be all for it. But I could see how in the future everyone would be doing it more or less. But you'd still get the Manning style, MS Dhoni style of totally don't need to say all that much in the ear. I almost think that when you're watching from off the field and you've got your coach, your assistant coach, maybe your bowling, your batting, your fielding coach. So you've got that 5-person group. You've probably got, in modern cricket, you've got at least one analyst, maybe two analysts in the room. You have like this really great ability to have incredibly interesting conversations about the game as it's going on, which you can't really do in basketball and football and everything because everything's moving too quickly. But cricket has those pauses, so you can have those conversations. So you could see how it could be really, really helpful. The other thing is, how much different is it than what Nathan Lehman and Owen Morgan do with their chess moves pieces? It's a fine line, right? He's getting messages to the captain of England or Kolkata from off-field already. So in some ways, we're already doing it. And every time a fielder goes to the boundary, there's a bowling coach there whispering in their ear, telling them stuff. So I could see this would make a lot of people angry, but I can also see that we're maybe already on our way there.
I mean, what I would like to see if they are to make it work is that I think it would be a necessity maybe to record the conversation and then some corruption person or anti-corruption person goes over it. So at least that takes care of the fixing part, right? The other thing that I was thinking of in terms of caveats is that let's suppose you're the coach, right? You have a screen in front of you and there's been an LBW shout and the umpire hasn't raised his finger. So as a coach now, I can tell the on-field captain whether to review it or not because I have a better vision courtesy of all the cameras. And that, I think, would put the game into disrepute because, I don't know, that should be an on-field call. That shouldn't come from outside.
I don't know what it's like in all sports. Obviously, I watch a lot more basketball. But when a basketball coach is going to make a decision, they quite often look up at the big screen before they make their reviews anyway. So I can't imagine that that isn't happening in other sports already. And if you remember, we used to have that. Teams used to turn around and look at the dugout to see if people had, more the change room than the dugout, and see yes or no whether they should take the review. We decided in cricket we didn't want that, which is fine. Again, isn't that just giving the team more of a chance of getting the decision right anyway? So I don't know if I have an issue with that again. But you're right. I mean, we've already started with substitutions. We're not going to end with the silly substitution rule we have at the moment, right? It's going to go further than that. We already have an analyst making decisions off the field. We already have coaches now on the boundary, as you said, and Sammy's doing it. He's not the first coach I've seen in T20 cricket to do that. We already have these things happening. I think there will be a natural progression towards those sorts of things one way or another, whether occasionally we decide not to. I mean, baseball is a perfect example of baseball was progressing towards having the fielders in the position where the players actually hit it. And baseball fans said, no, we don't want that. We might find a situation in T20 cricket where we're like, no, we want Dhoni. We don't want Brendan McCullum or Stephen Fleming in their ear.
That's actually one interesting thing because you will have these captains who will be like, no, I don't want to diminish my power as the decision maker. But then again, cricket is one of those sports in which the captain has to make a lot of decisions. You know, captains in other teams or sports don't have to do that. But the cricket captain has so many things to think about. Field settings, bowling changes, matchups. Okay, what time do I need to use this bowler in a test match? What's the surface playing like right now? What will happen when the ball gets older? It's a lot of information for one person. So on one hand, you'll have the captains or those sort of captains who'll be like, nah, we're fine without the earpiece because we want to do all these things ourselves and we don't want to have our head crowded. But on the other hand, the positive is that it kind of releases some of the pressure off from the captain and you have the entire management making those calls. So, I mean, there are pros and cons on both sides. It's going to be interesting to see how this sort of innovation develops or whether we see it at all or not.
No, agreed. I do think it is interesting. I think cricket will change quite a lot in the next 10 years because I think the new generation is moving through who doesn't see all these things that you know, Mancat is a perfect example of this, of just people being like, wait a minute, we're upset at the bowler because the batter can't stay in his crease. I think there's a whole new generation of people who are looking at cricket differently and hopefully we're part of that conversation on here as well. And in the future, I think there will be things. Whether this is one of them, though, I don't know.
Like, you know, you very rightly pointed out Mancad and how that's a cultural thing. Different countries respond to it differently across the globe. And Ashwin has been that torchbearer. I've seen so many instances, you know, when they're checking for the no ball in the PSL, where they could have done it, right? The batters are always outside of the crease. And now, why are the batters always outside of the crease? Because Pakistan has kind of taken that stance that they don't like this. And that's how
they... You know why? It's because the army would stop them from going out of the crease.
Easy there now. If not you, they might nick me. But anyway, final topic of the day. Of course, we had some wholesome content last week when we mentioned that moment between Colin Munro and the ball boy. And so I thought, and some of our team members suggested that we have this one on over here as well. Viv Richards running onto the field when the Quetta Gladiators qualified for the playoffs. We've seen Viv be this passionate in the PSL year after year. It's been going on for 8-9 years now. Never, ever gets old. And he's not someone who is actively involved in cricket all year round, but comes around for the PSL. He's just a mentor for the Gladiators. And I feel like when you think of the PSL, you think of Viv Richards and Darren Sammy and David Visa and all those people who have been so deeply entrenched with the fabric of the tournament and Pakistan cricket and everything that surrounds it. That's kind of one of the unique selling points of this tournament. And did you catch the video? Did you watch him make that run?
Yeah, no, I did. Here's the thing about Viv Richards. I've met him a couple of times and he's a natural competitor. Even when he's I've always found him to be a lovely person when I've met him, but he's a natural competitor. You could just see it within him. And I remember a few years ago being really angry with, there was an Indian guru. I think his name's Sadguru. I think is his name. Complete charlatan, self-help, bullshit, nonsense. The same as all those sort of people are. And he did this video where he said, you know, Virat Kohli is like Viv Richards, but unlike Viv Richards, who is just laid back and chilled and, you know, doesn't take anything too seriously, Virat Kohli has a real fiery passion within him. And other than the fact it was a racist stereotype of West Indies, I was like, have you never seen Viv Richards bat? Like, you're wrong on a cricket level before anything else. And I think that you go back and you look at Viv Richards, there's a fire within him, right? That to be successful for almost political reasons and, you know, based on who he was and where he came from and everything else, he's just a competitive human being. And I think what that video kind of shows is that it's still there. And it doesn't always go there. I know former players, I've had this conversation with a couple of players who kind of, when they retire, let it all go. And they just become like grandfathers, like at the age of 35 and 36. It's incredible to watch because you can see it. They are at 34, you don't even want to have a beer with them. And at 36, you're just like, oh, okay, he's come out of the bubble now and he's a normal person. And Viv isn't one of those people. The reason that Viv Richards is one of the greatest cricketers who has ever existed is in part because he has this incredible fire going through him at all times. And, you know, I was having a conversation with a former cricketer recently, and we were talking about Viv still being involved in the PSL. And he said, it's an embarrassment. Like, you know, he's not even coaching. What's he doing there? Blah, blah, blah. And I said, I think Viv just wants to be there because he likes to do stuff like that. Like, I'm not saying the money isn't a part of it because, hey, we all take the money. But I think he could go on the he's Viv Richards. He could turn up in commentary boxes and he could go on the speaking circuit and he could take photos with people at old sports conferences and he could do many different things in order to get the money. Viv really likes that side of it, that competitive side of it. It's not an accident that he was one of the greatest cricketers of all time. It is part of him. And so, you know, watching him get so excited over that, I think that's important. I think it's also important to T20 cricket that it's now at a level that someone like him can take it as seriously as he does. Do you know what I mean? You know, early on we had the Shane Warne saying Yusuf Pathan was one of the greatest innings of all time. No one even talks about that innings anymore, by the way. Yeah. And we all just went, oh, fucking hell. Okay, Warney. Whereas now we are starting to see some former players really take this shit seriously. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened with one day cricket. See, people don't, the kids now are not old enough to remember that in the 90s, one day cricket was not taken seriously. Like I asked Ricky Ponting once why he took one day cricket so seriously when all the players before him hadn't. And he said, I didn't know they weren't taking it seriously until I got to the Australian team. Right. And it takes that sort of thing, but it also takes the commentators taking it seriously and the coaches taking it seriously and everything else. And T20 cricket now is a really important thing. And I love that Viv gives a shit because, you know, it keeps him a little bit relevant too. Mm-hmm. You know, it keeps his name alive. And who knows what's going to happen in the future of cricket, but Viv Richards may not always be in the first name that comes out of our mouths. And he was the greatest white ball player, even before it was white ball cricket, by such a distance that it is incredible how much better he was than any other player in his era. And he never got to cash in on that on the way he does, but he gets these moments and he gets to be involved. I think it's really cool.
I mean, he's literally run that amount of distance in celebration.
Also, good on him for being fit enough to be able to run. Well, how old is he?
He's probably in his late 60s, isn't he? I'd have to imagine that he is.
You're not going to be running like that at his age.
No.
I mean, to be fair,
I probably
could run. 72.
Oh, there he is, 72. Yeah.
No, you couldn't run like that now, let alone when you're 72.
That's what I was going to say. He could outrun me as is. I'm a 30-year-old. He's 72. He would win.
Right? Yeah, my knees hurt watching him do it, if I'm being honest. So, no, I just thought it was great. He really is a special cricketer in the history of our game. And I don't like any disrespect to Viv, because I think what happened with Viv was everyone got sucked up in the coolness of Viv. And I think that's great. And he obviously was a different kind of player. You know, with all due respect, you know, Dennis Compton and Keith Miller, we didn't have too many cool cricketers before Viv, right? We had a couple, but not many. But that disrespects how great he was at cricket and the way he thought about the game and how far ahead he was in one day cricket compared to anyone else of his generation. He was really the, you know, the WG Grace of T20 cricket. in that he was so far ahead of that generation. He's not. It's not like a Bradman situation. We're talking about literally. He was a great player at it when it wasn't even a real thing.
That's true. And I mean, it's fitting, all the more fitting that he's involved in a Premier T20 competition. And, you know, we all love to watch him get all passionate like that. And I'm sure there's so much inspiration that all of those guys in the Quetta dressing room draw for him and have been drawing from him for years on end, because he's been constantly involved. And, you know, Pakistan cricket for a lot of times is all about the vibes. He's definitely kind of fulfilled that bit. Anyway, that wraps up this uncovered episode. So everyone in the comment section who was interacting, except you, J.S. Smith, you can go fuck off. All of you guys, thank you so much. And if you like this video, throw in a like, share it with your friends. And subscribe to both this channel and Jared's other main channel on YouTube. We'll be back with another episode of Uncovered next week. That's all for today. Goodbye.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bahram Kazi and Estelle Vassadevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku, as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recording. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, you will need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up great clips from your podcast chats and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.